people who are really keen on participating in this seminar as well. From there, I said I couldn't handle having two hookups. You know, there's just too many ways in which that could go badly. What they are going to do, nevertheless, is they're going to hold their own seminar each week, tracking exactly what we do, write comments, which will then get included in our weekly interrogation, so it'll be part of it. And then maybe once or twice during the semester, well, several times during the semester, they're organizing a hookup just with the Argentinians, so they will have a conversation about this. And then once things, if this actually happens, and they stick with it, then I think sometime in the course of the semester we'll attempt a three-way hookup just so everybody can be part of our collective discussion of this material. Has everybody had it? I made copies of this. I assume that a lot of you, does anybody need? Okay.
Even though you said you printed out in the actual syllabus.
Anybody else want to? You can all have extras if you want to give them to friends and family. I shouldn't have actually printed out this many. I haven't quite adjusted to the new efficiencies of posting everything and getting them distributed. So it really isn't necessary to print things out en masse. So let me just say a little bit. I don't have a lot to say that isn't already written down in the introductory material of the syllabus. I've never taught a seminar quite the way we're doing this one. You know, in some ways, I suppose I'm being incredibly indulgent. That is, getting a bunch of smart and eager and interested, motivated people as a captive audience and forcing you to read chapters of my book. With doing it at a sufficiently leisurely pace that you'll actually be able to read it carefully, and then having the pleasure of a 2.5-hour discussion on the drafts of chapters I'm writing. Yeah, so I, on the one hand, it's a little presumptuous on my part, I suppose, to imagine that this book has enough meat in it to sustain a serious discussion for a whole semester. I hope that's true. But I feel just terribly grateful for the chance to have such a careful discussion of the work. You should all know that, you know, this is a real chance to make a difference in a text. I feel that this is pretty far along. I'm not giving you a rough draft of my fragmented notes. This is a near complete draft. There's some chapters that have gaps in them, and one chapter that needs a fairly significant overhaul, although I may have accomplished that before we get to it. It's one at the end of the book. But these are all of the chapters contain very complex and difficult issues around which full resolution is simply not possible. I don't think of the weaknesses of the book as mainly failures of imagination on my part, but failures of understanding because of the nature of the problems and where the conversation in the world is around these themes. So these are all reasons why, out of this seminar, real improvements and changes and refinements can come. So your the weekly participation in both the discussions and in the reading and in writing your interrogations, they all have this slightly different character. You're not reading stuff as some people say, dead white man. Not yet, anyway. And this is very much work in progress, in which I hope we all feel as a collaborative effort we can push things forward. Now, among other things, it means I am interested in just simple editorial questions. You know, so if you hit patches in some chapters which just don't seem clear to you, where there is something difficult or awkward, it's totally great. I would love you to flag those for me as well. Not that we'll spend a lot of time just talking about typos, but you know, really anything, even at that level, is stuff I would appreciate. More to the point, I think I hope that the ideas are pretty well refined and that this will produce really stimulating and interesting and focused conversations on the array of problems that the book addresses. The book is the culmination, although not necessarily the final piece of, a project I've been directing since the early 1990s called the Real Utopias Project. 5 books have been published out of that project, a 6th is in press, each of which is focused on a particular problem of institutional design and social transformation. But none of them steps back from the particularities of the specific problems which they're engaging to kind of pose the more general question of thinking about alternatives to existing capitalisms and how to approach the general problem of radical transformation and alternative. Particularly in the context where older socialist models of alternatives to capitalism no longer have the taken-for-granted credibility that they had 30 years ago when I began working on these themes. So the book is therefore an attempt at both providing that broader framework and making a substantive contribution to how we should think about movements in the direction of alternatives beyond capitalism. The book is firmly rooted in the Marxist tradition. It will be a matter of debate, I think, whether it has strayed from the core theses of that tradition in ways that render it no longer Marxist. I don't find the labeling question of particular interest, although there are substantive issues involved with those debates. You know, what are the central ideas of that tradition and which hold it together? I myself think this is still firmly Marxian in its argument and character, the questions it asks, the categories it uses, which is not to say that it's correct, but just to say that it's part of that theoretical tradition. Now, again, this is all in the syllabus. My thought for this as a pedagogical event, not just an editorial one, is the best way to organize your work in the seminar is for you to write term papers, which are basically case studies that don't necessarily fit into my framework. I'm not insisting that you all adopt my socialism as social empowerment and envisioning real utopias framework for thinking about alternatives. It's fine for you to have your own, you know, theoretical political coordinates. But that the term papers have the character of being centered around either historical or empirical cases or theoretical proposals for specific institutional designs. What I don't think would be the best would be to have a term paper that's attempting to construct a whole alternative framework as such. You know, I don't think a 30 or 40 page or 20 to 40 page term paper that's attempting a major reconstruction of the whole big meta framework is likely to be very successful in the constraints of a one semester course, whereas really trying to get your head around a concrete historical, or it could be theoretical proposal, but a proposal that really pays attention to the problem of the institutional design of fundamentally different kinds of social arrangements. Really worrying about how things work and not just what are the moral principles involved or the very abstract concepts involved. I think that's what would be the most productive. And my thought then is that at the end of the semester, as I think, again, if you've read through the syllabus, you'll know, the idea is that at the end of the semester we're going to have a mini-conference which I will organize in a rather formal academic manner. I think the way to do this mini-conference is to pretend it's the American Sociological Association meetings, so to speak. We'll have panels and questions from the floor, and we'll run it like a regular professional conference in that way. That, therefore, will also give you a chance to present papers under those kinds of conditions, which I think is a good thing to do. At that conference, there's a number of other people coming who are not part of the seminar itself. So there hopefully will be several people from the Argentine group. What I've offered them is any of them that actually write a paper. So they don't get a ticket to Madison just for sitting and listening to the webcast. But if they actually write a term paper, then they're invited to come to the conference. And I've gotten some outside funding in which I can probably bring 4 people, and I could stretch it to 5. What I've told the students in Argentina is that I'll be able to heavily subsidize their trip, and they should try to get some local funding. So even if they get, you know, $100 a piece, that would be enough then to add an additional person probably to the amount. So there'll be 3 or 4 or 5 people from Argentina. I gave a mini seminar on the mini course on the same material in Berkeley last October to a group of about this size, a few more than this, about 12 people. And several of them said they wanted to write papers, that there's no paper requirement for that mini course. And I told them that if they wrote term papers along the same model of what we're talking about, then I would also figure out a way to fund them to come. And then finally, at the University of Minnesota, I gave a talk on envisioning real utopias in December, and there's a group of left-wing students in the sociology department who've kind of organized themselves as a left caucus in the department. And they seem very eager to come and join, not write papers, but just come as participants in the conference. And I told them if they did come as a group, then I would we would have a slot in some time period in the weekend where they could present whatever they wanted to. They could just organize a session to discuss their work or whatever conversation they wanted to have with us. So this will make the... Great. Here comes our power cord.
Yeah.
And that's not compatible. I'm sorry.
Oh. Okay.
I've got the old one.
All right. Sorry.
Next time.
Oh.
Well, hopefully we'll be okay.
Okay. See you, Patrick. Right.
Thank you. Sorry. We're okay.
Yeah. And, you know, we're not going to go for 2.5 hours today anyway. So there's going to be an assortment of other people coming to this. And there's even the following possibility. Vivek Chibber, who's a former student of mine who teaches at NYU, has a group of Marxist sort of class-oriented grad students who have been talking about trying to set up a network of grad students interested in class analysis and social change, basically left and critical sociology, in which the student network would hold kind of an annual gathering for students to share research and discuss issues. And Vivek had the idea that perhaps this retreat in early May would be an occasion for several of the students from New York to also join us. And if that were to happen, then we'd also have a session where that issue of constructing a network would also be part of what was in play. So that's what we have at the end of the semester. A couple of you have been to such events at this university retreat where I hold end of semester seminar mini conferences, but never in May. It's a whole different, we usually do this in December. In May, we can also add to the weekend recreation wonderful canoeing on the Wisconsin River, although it'll probably snow. You never know. Now, because this is a more elaborate event, I think what people really should plan on is having it be the whole weekend. Normally, we've done this from first thing Saturday morning and then basically ending at noon on Sunday. I think this time the idea will be to start on Friday evening, have some kind of opening event on Friday evening, and go all day Saturday and Sunday, and late afternoon Sunday, which will give us time, you know, not to do this at such a pace that everybody gets mentally overwhelmed, but also to have it be a time where we can really enjoy the place, and particularly if a group comes from New York and from other places, we can use this for intellectual academic network purposes, building solidarities around critical themes, and not just fulfilling a requirement at the end of the semester. Is it feasible for everybody? You know, there are sometimes people have the kinds of constraints where it's really tough to go away for a weekend, but does everybody in the class, is this feasible for everybody? I'll be able to cover nearly all, and possibly all the costs. It kind of depends upon what happens with the Argentinians and what the airfares are, how squeezed my budget for this will be. So I'm anticipating that this will be free, but if it's not, we're talking about, you know, $10 or $15 a person. It's not going to be expensive in any case. All right. What other things of a pragmatic character? Has everybody had a chance to read through the requirements and the... Was everything clear about this? Okay, now the one other thing on the syllabus I'd just like to talk about briefly. At the very end, there's this, on page 7 and 8, there's this list of...
It ends at 6.
What?
It ends at 6.
This one doesn't end it. That one does?
Mine did.
Oh, yours? Oh, you all need the ones I brought. Because I added, you all downloaded them before I changed it. Now, this is the new version. This is page 7 and 8. See, it was worthwhile.
It was serendipitous.
Yeah. Right. I've listed on page 7 and 8, 9 questions that need to guide any interrogation of concrete proposals for institutional transformations, whether these be macro institutions. So if you're thinking about sort of the real fundamental macro design of an economy, capitalism versus socialism, these are questions you'd ask. If you're thinking about worker co-ops, these are questions you'd ask. If you're thinking about designs for new democratic institutions of participation at the urban level, these are questions you'd ask. This is a set of orienting questions. I'll briefly go through them in a moment. I'm also considering, but this is something for us to collectively decide, I'm considering the following idea for your papers, that is to create a kind of common template so that all the papers actually answer all these questions. I mean, the simplest form of that would be, in a sense, for your term papers to be kind of like questionnaires, right? You've got these 9 questions. You write a few pages or however many you need on each of these questions about your case study. That's a little rigid. You know, it doesn't have much literary flair to it, too. And it doesn't necessarily give room for the storytelling that a lot of case studies will want to have. One idea is that you have an initial section which is storytelling, which you give a narrative account of the phenomenon you're studying. And then you basically just march through these questions. The advantage of that is that in the conference and in our discussions, we would then have a really careful way of comparing all these cases, because everybody would have been talking about the problem of robust sustainability, the question of scalability, and so on, these other elements. I'll briefly mention them in a moment. I don't want to decide that unilaterally, that we should have a common template for all the papers. I think that's something to just let mull for a while. But it occurred to me for this particular seminar that could actually work pretty well. And then one can always later rewrite the papers for publication in a more fluid way rather than in that more rigid format. I know I'm sort of meandering from point to point here. That reminds me of a fundamental principle which some of you have heard from me before, but which I want to reiterate since there are some people I'm just meeting here today. And that's the principle that when you're a graduate student, you no longer have homework and assignments. Everything you're doing, you should be doing because it's an enhancement of your knowledge and capacities and engagement with the world. And in particular, every paper you write, you should write in the hope that it'll eventually appear in print somewhere. Now, I don't mean that every paper you write as a graduate student does get published. You know, some things can't develop that way. But you should treat the drafts that you write as term papers in this class as something that you hope eventually could be revised in a form that is worth sharing with other people. The purpose of writing is communication. It's not just filling requirements. So what I really hope is that as you think through what your topics are and what problems you want to work on, that you approach this from the vantage point of how can this be turned into a publishable piece. One possibility, but not one that I want to be front and center in our collective project for the semester, but one possibility is that if the case studies are interesting and diverse enough, and particularly since there'll be some from Argentina and other places, it's conceivable that there'll be a collective volume that could come out of the course. That has happened in classes in various places. It's very hard to predict in advance whether the work will be of sufficient interest to warrant that, but it's at least something to keep in mind. It's a kind of nice, I think of it as a sort of nice fantasy that I publish Envisioning Real Utopias, and then there's a companion volume, Case Studies in Real Utopias, which would be done by students working on particular kinds of institutional settings. But, you know, probably that's not in the cards, but it's possible. Let me just very quickly go down this list of questions to be sure that everything is clear. And by the way, you should all feel free to, I know I'm giving this long monologue here, right? You should all feel free to ask questions, interrupt, raise issues. This doesn't have to be just me rambling on and on. I'll just ask straight out. Any questions? Any issues or reactions to anything that's been said so far?
I think providing a framework with questions may be really helpful, because I know I've had some trouble trying to write in the case study that I'm looking at, which I believe fits into this framework of, of this framework. But, it's hard to try to figure out where to focus in when you're trying to write between these levels of the practical and the, and the idealistic. So I find that these would be really helpful.
Good. Well, I'm inclined to develop it this way. I mean, this is not meant as an outline, what I presented here. These are just issues that need to be talked about. So I'd have to give it some thought, and I would then propose a structure of a paper with subsections in which you discuss this and you discuss that, in which would encompass these things. I'll work on coming up with a good template of that sort. But then these questions as the background questions that you answer to fill that template. Okay, so let me just briefly go through these. So if you are exploring a real utopian proposal, whether it be a discussion of an historical example, the 19th century intentional communities, or a contemporary empirical case, Porto Alegre's participatory budget, something we'll read a little bit about, or a theoretical case. What I mean by a theoretical model, for example, is something like John Romer's market socialism, which we will discuss at least briefly. It's a theoretical model in the sense that you can't really find an example of an actual society that has tried to institute his model of market socialism, but he specifies it with enough institutional detail that you can ask all these questions about it. Some discussions of socialism don't specify institutional details. So Marx's discussion of socialism is so vague. There's a few principles here and there, but they're not principles that have the character of establishing what the institutional design is. And so you can't really criticize it in this way. You can't ask about its robust sustainability, its scalability, because you don't know exactly what it is, except in very vague terms. My preference for your papers is that in general, empirical cases will be better, because then you can really sink your teeth into stuff that's really happened in the world and ask how it works and how it fails, where its contradictions are. It's a more difficult task to do that carefully for a purely theoretical model, but there are some quite interesting theoretical models we'll be discussing at various points in the semester, and I don't have any objection in principle to somebody wanting to do that. Okay. The first question is about the normative foundation. My framework for envisioning real utopias and thinking about alternatives has as a kind of premise that there's some objection to the world as it exists that we have. We have some diagnosis of existing institutions of power, privilege, inequality. Some diagnosis of those which leads us to criticize them as violating some moral standard that we care about. That the basis for wanting to seek alternatives centers around some normative principle, which is grounded, therefore, in some kind of philosophical perspective. Marx himself wasn't very sympathetic to that way of thinking about capitalism, for example. He wasn't very sympathetic to the idea that the reason we want to go beyond capitalism is because there's something we object to in capitalism. That there's some issue of social justice, there's some issue of the kind of world we think would be desirable. His view, his manifest view, was that the reason we criticize capitalism is because it's against our interests, and our interests are the interests of the working class. So the working class would do better in an alternative, and that's the reason to seek an alternative. It's not because the alternative is more just or more humane or more moral. It's just that it's in the interest of workers. So the reason why workers want socialism is the same reason why in feudalism capitalists want capitalism. Capitalists do better in capitalism than they do constrained by the restrictions of feudalism. Workers do better in socialism than they do constrained by the structures of capitalism. But that's just an argument about interests. There's no social justice claims. There's no moral or normative claims. I don't think Marx actually believed that, is my view. I mean, I'm being presumptuous to imagine what's going on in his head, but he acted as if he also objected to capitalism as an injustice, as a source of real harms that were unjustifiable. But in any case, regardless of what Marx's view on these matters are, I think at this point in history, any proposals for alternatives should try to clarify what the underlying normative principles are. What are you really trying to accomplish? What are the values that you're hoping to see realized by the proposal that you're exploring? That's this first kind of question, is laying bare the normative foundations. The second one is what I'm calling design principles. And this is basically trying to elaborate how the institution in question is supposed to work. What are the rules that govern its functioning? How is it actually structured? So in the case of discussing something like participatory budgeting, which is one example we will look at, it's not enough to say that the Porto Alegre system of urban budgets involved lots of citizen participation in the budget process. Now, it's not that that's false, but that doesn't tell you anything about how it works. The design for Porto Alegre, you'd have to say, well, in this particular case, the city was divided up into regions, 17 of them, and they also had what they called thematic regions, that is, citywide regions that were organized around themes, culture, and recreation is a thematic assembly. Citizens could meet in these assemblies. They met at the beginning of a budget cycle in plenary session and then chose delegates for working sessions, etc., etc. So by design principle, I mean the nitty-gritty of how the institution actually works. How detailed that is, how fine-grained you actually go in explaining the design, that'll vary a lot from topic to topic. If you were discussing a very specific case, then you'll probably want to give a lot of such details. If you're discussing a family of cases, for example, if you wanted to study worker co-ops, you don't have to pick the Madison Union Cab and do a case study of Union Cab. It can be about worker co-ops. Now, worker co-ops vary quite a bit in their design. And what you might want to do under design principles is say, look, worker co-ops have the following general design characteristics, but they vary in the following ways. And so you know, exactly how you orchestrate laying out design principles would depend upon what the problem at hand is. But I do want to emphasize that it's important, I think, to pay attention to details, because that's partially what the real and the real utopia is meant to be about. That is, for utopian ideals to actually work in the world, they have to be instantiated in real institutions in which the devil is often in the detail, not just in the vague principles. Context conditions is a difficult kind of question, and one at least that you need to engage. By context conditions, I mean that any given design of an institution of whatever sort, a workers' co-op, for example, may be robust and effective under certain conditions and a complete catastrophe under others. So a simple case, in the case of worker co-ops, would be if you have worker co-ops existing in an economic environment where there are rules of credit markets which make it possible for co-ops to get subsidized credit below ordinary market credit, because the state will insure some of the risk of lending to people who don't have collateral. You know, so if you can solve some of the credit market failures, then co-ops could be vibrant. If co-ops have to get money from regular banks who are using standard commercial loan criteria before they will lend money, and the workers who come to get the loan don't have collateral, then co-ops may have a disaster. So part of the context for the viability of co-ops would depend upon the nature of credit markets. The nature of the credit markets is not itself a design principle of the co-ops themselves, but of the context within which they occur. Now, sometimes the distinction between the design principles of the institution and the context aren't so clear. You know, you can pack the context as part of the institutional design, and you could for co-ops. You could say the design really is a credit market co-op design, because the credit market problem is the pivotal one, you could decide. That would be fine. I don't want to fetishize these kinds of distinctions and make them rigid, but you do have to pay attention to both the interior design principles of whatever it is you're talking about and the broader context within which it would work. Another example for this would be unconditional basic income is a very interesting and provocative proposal for redesigning the way income distribution works. Giving everybody unconditionally a basic income acquired by the state through taxation and redistributed as an unconditional grant to people. Now, it could be that unconditional basic income works very well in a population that has a strong work ethic and will work very badly in a population that basically likes to sit on the beach, right? That is, in order for basic income to be viable, people have to want to still work, mostly, so that they will generate the income which gets redistributed as basic income. That would be a cultural context. So Puritanism would be good for basic income, because everybody's driven to work. A stereotypical Latin culture of wanting to lay back and enjoy life might not be so good for basic income. It might make it less viable, because people would take advantage of the basic income to withdraw from productive activity.
So the cultural context that would be most conducive to the institution might be the thing that's undermining it most as well.
Right. Yeah. So rampant consumerism is good for basic income, because the basic income isn't going to let you buy big screen televisions. Just so if you're in a consumerist culture where you constantly want to consume more, you're going to have to work beyond the basic income. Anyway, the context conditions are important, and you need to think them through when you discuss whatever the case study. Robust sustainability. This is probably the theoretically most important problem. It's easy for us to imagine alternative ways of organizing things. The question is, do they self-destruct? Do they have perverse, unintended consequences? That's what I mean by a contradiction. By a contradiction, I mean, in this context, that there's some kind of unintended consequence which undermines the conditions of possibility of the institution in question. In the case of basic income, for example, the perverse unintended consequence would be if basic income leads to such a withdrawal of labor from productive activity that not enough income is generated to provide the basic income. That would be an example of non-sustainability. Discussions of the failure of Soviet planning are filled with examples of how once the simple tasks of extensive industrialization were accomplished, intensive industrialization, deepening the rationality and the efficiency of production, produced all sorts of pathologies because the planning apparatus simply couldn't plan those things from the center. So there's a lot of discussions about why central planning, you know, if the plan says we want 50,000 tons of glass produced by a glass factory, they produce these really big windows that are very thick because it's easier. Yeah, and so the problem of robust sustainability is one you have to give a lot of attention to. But it's a hard one. And it's very hard in case studies to necessarily just sort it out. Because the reasons why any given case may have problems may not have to do with anything wrong with the design or with the context, but just with contingent facts. You know, American imperialism can destroy progressive possibilities that would have worked just fine if it hadn't been for militaristic and other forms of intervention. And to say that that shows that it wasn't sustainable because of an external threat. It's true that the external threat blocks it, but it's not because of any design problem. Here we're really interested in how the designs work and whether the designs are self-defeating. Scalability. Scalability won't necessarily be a central issue for every case study that you do. But for many, there is the issue of whether a particular design principle only works in very small local settings. And the only sense in which it's scalable would be replicability and, you know, and diffusion, but not that it could be ratcheted up to higher levels of organization. A co-op is a good example. We all know that workers' co-ops work extremely well in certain small settings. You can have workers' co-ops that produce in a local market that are robust, they remain democratic and egalitarian, they last for a long time. The question is, could you really organize General Motors as a workers' co-op? Well, maybe you could, maybe you couldn't, but that's the scalability problem. What would be different about having a multinational co-op with factories all over the world? Could that really remain a co-op or not? Well, I don't know. That would be the scalability problem. Did you have your hand up?
Yeah. Sort of a basic question before we continue. When you're talking about cases, are you talking about us looking at examples where we can kind of see how these things have played out, or are you talking about figuring out maybe some situations that can be used in a more alternative way?
You should try to speak up a little.
Speak up a little so it gets into the microphone for the.
Do I have to repeat everything?
No, that's all right. I have a very open-ended view as to what I mean by examples for this, you know, for your case studies. I'd say that the most important thing is that you really care about this thing you're writing your paper about. It's something that matters to you, so that you really put your passions into it. I could see a paper in this course being on a very specific instance of somebody could do a case study of a particular workers' co-op. A workers' co-op embodies democratic and egalitarian values. The normative foundations are quite different from ordinary capitalism. And you could study all these things, ask all these questions about a very particular historical empirical example. Or you could, as I said, you could study workers' co-ops, not just a particular type. Or you could study cases that only partially embody some real utopian ideal and ask what, in this case, blocked it being able to build and expand. You can study failures in that sense or incomplete cases. I would prefer the seminar to be focused on edgy possibilities that are really at the limits and sometimes beyond the limits. You know, when I say beyond the limits of what's possible, I mean that they're very deviant cases. And if they fail, then we learned something about the nature of limits and possibilities from their failure. Did you have something in mind where you weren't sure if it would fit, or?
My education, so I'm always thinking schools.
Mm-hmm.
And, I see that many educational policies, they have adopted a lot of progressive language, which cannot be really implemented. So it's not that schools are doing that, because eventually they can't, because there's a lot of contradictions going on, so they can't actually do it. But still, those policies could be used to gain a more socialist or more progressive, if you want,
mm-hmm.
way of implementing them. So, for example, a concrete one you're thinking about is like Trump picking up these policies and just picturing or envisioning how they would look like if they were really, the conditions were really set up for them to work.
No, that would be, the idea of a paper that was a kind of, let's say, an update of Pablo Freire, right, or something. The real utopian design for public education in a complex world in which you draw on the historical failures of partial implementation and pseudo-implementation as some of the raw materials, but then you're really saying, here's the architecture for such a design, which, if the context was favorable, would work. That would have the character of a kind of combination of a theoretical model. These are the principles that you'd actually put in place if I could magically design an education system. So it's partially a theoretical model. And then the empirical material would come from then looking at partial cases and failed cases and perhaps even some successful cases. Sure. I think that's would be a totally appropriate. Okay. Scalability. Divisibility. Divisibility is, in a way, less a question of the design of the real utopian alternative itself and more a question of its implementation. That is, some kinds of proposals for change are all or nothing. You have to put them in place in a big bang way, or they won't work. You don't get half of the moral virtue from half the policy, right? So an example of, at least some people have argued, for basic income, that a partial basic income is a bad thing. If you give people a basic income that's below subsistence, that you cannot live on, it will have different consequences from giving people a basic income that actually allows them to freely choose whether they're going to work for market wages or engage in socially productive activity that doesn't generate a market income. And if the reason why you want to give a basic income is because you want to enhance people's capacity to opt out of the market and into the social economy, if that's the normative foundation, then a partial basic income doesn't give it to you. Only a full basic income would give it to you. So that would be an example for basic income where at least some people have argued you've really got to get to some threshold, otherwise it's actually a bad idea to do. There are various proposals in the latest book in the Real Utopias Project on gender equality. There are various aspects about strategies for subsidizing caregiving labor, where an incomplete subsidy can actually lead to a strengthening of gender division, whereas a full subsidy gives people freedom to break out of gender divisions. So it's an issue to think about for your proposal. What happens if you have this wonderful design, but you can only do part of it? Does that give you a way station, you know, a halfway house which you can then build on? Or does it create a barrier to further development? So sometimes socialists have argued that no reform is better than partial reform, because partial reform is an obstacle to full reform. the kind of strongest version of that is that things have to get worse before they get better, right? So you don't even want to make things better. Well, this is just an issue you have to think about. That's the divisibility issue. Negative unintended consequences, I think that's basically the same as robust sustainability. Although I suppose, I'll have to think about it, whether these deserve two separate entries. You can have negative and unintended consequences which don't undermine the institution. They're just negative consequences. So then you have good things and bad things, pros and cons. So you have to examine those negative unintended consequences, which may, in the end, not affect the sustainability of a proposal, but merely cause other harms, collateral damage, so to speak. Number eight is something which we don't usually spend much time thinking about, and that's positive unintended consequences. But I think it's worth asking about it, because there are positive externalities, to use a kind of economist term, that are often unrecognized by certain kinds of egalitarian proposals, and which actually add a lot of credibility as to why we would want them, that aren't the primary motivation for the institution, for why you would do it. The example that I like to use for this particular point is nobody that I know of has ever proposed basic income as a solution to the very difficult problem of how to organize agricultural subsidies in rich countries that don't harm the third world. Right? So that's a whole different problem. International trade and agricultural commodities, and the fact that to protect French farmers you harm farmers in Africa wherever, right? The protectionism problem. The problem with agricultural subsidies is that they end up subsidizing agribusiness. The motivation for agricultural subsidies, the political motivation and the social forces behind it, is because there's some sentimental reasons why we like to have a world with small farmers. The countryside would look a lot different, both farmers and non-farmers. Urban people would rather have small farmers around than to have no farmers around. It's basically the political clout and role of small farmers that provides the ideological justification for agricultural subsidies, but it's big agribusiness that gets the benefit. Well, an unconditional basic income is a subsidy to small farmers. It means that small farmers have their basic subsistence guaranteed independently of how profitable their farms are, and that actually enables a small farmer to reproduce him or herself under competitive conditions, because they don't have to generate their whole income out of their farming. But unconditional basic income actually harms big farms because it makes agricultural labor more expensive. So it does exactly what you'd want. So it's a positive externality of unconditional basic income, is that it harms agribusiness and helps small farmers. That would be, just an example of something I'm talking about. So whatever you're doing, if you're doing something on education or on urban land reform is being proposed and is being instituted because it's helping the homeless and the propertyless and doing all sorts of things around the quality of life for the people who are the direct beneficiaries. Then the question is, are there also positive externalities? And what might they be? And then finally, political feasibility. That's, in a way, moving beyond the real utopias problem. The real utopias problematic, what defines it as an object of inquiry, is the design of viable alternatives that accomplish our normative goals. The achievability of those alternatives, I argue, is a separate problem. This is really about achievability and about what are the conditions under which you could actually institute on a large scale whatever it is the proposals you're talking about. All right, so that's my inventory at the moment. We can add, by the way, in the course of our discussions, we may add questions to this list. These are just a kind of preliminary set of guidelines. So as even this early in the semester, as you begin to chew over possibilities for your term papers and think about them, you might even begin to take notes on these different themes. So one thing you can do is create a folder in your computer structure and you know, have a separate file for each of these themes, and as you think about it, just write yourself memos about how the design works, about the normative issues, about sustainability, divisibility. Just kind of build up a discursive narrative around these different themes as you begin to think about your term projects. Now, of course, what one usually does at the very beginning of seminars, even before I did all this little song and dance about term papers and like, is everybody introduces themselves. I was holding off on that just on the thought that perhaps there'd be some stragglers who would wend their way here. So why don't we do that? What I'd like you to do, partially because you're also introducing yourself to the five or six students in Argentina who will get this recording. So I'll send this, I'll either post it or burn it on a CD and send it to Rudolfo. So you should be introducing yourself to them. They will see you, the pictures of you, when we have our webcam hookup with them in the next week or the week after. But also, if you could say something about the sort of case that you are kind of thinking about, I assume that most of you have at least some general domain of interests around the whole agenda of envisioning real utopias that you're thinking through. So if you want to just say something about what you're chewing over in your head, that would be good to say at this point as well.
You wouldn't mean like you want me to start.
Well, there's a kind of natural, you know, either to the right or the left. I suppose on average these things go clockwise rather than counterclockwise, don't you think? Isn't it your intuition that you go around the table, doesn't it usually go clockwise?
Depends if you're right-handed or left-handed. Ambidextrous.
I think
who knows?
Start on the left.
Yeah.
Well, you're on my left.
Yeah. No, I know.
Okay.
All right. So, well, I'm Todd, I'm actually a little torn about what I want to do. As you probably most of you know, except not people listening on the roving eyeball looking camera, but my dissertation, which is still sort of a proposal stage, is about the politics of monetary and exchange rate policy in Argentina and Mexico, which is like the most un-utopian sounding thing that I think I can think of.
Yeah, a real utopian monetary policy.
But in all seriousness, though, one of the sort of the central concerns of the project is about sort of the problem of technocracy and what it means that central banks in particular, which are these organizations which make these tremendously consequential decisions that affect people's incomes, people's livelihoods, people's futures, the degree that they're exposed to risks, financial crises, things of that sort. These decisions are made not only by people who are completely insulated institutionally, but who are economists, who use arcane language that people don't understand, who conduct the conversations in a highly technical way. So, you know, one of the things I'm interested in is, well, you know, what would it mean to sort of democratize that? You know, is that even something that, you know, we should be thinking about, first of all? But if we were to be thinking about that, you know, what would democratic monetary policy look like, and what would a utopian sort of democratic monetary policy or whatever? I mean the other possibility is that, well, you know, in a socialist economy we wouldn't have money in the same way, you know, which is something I'm just a little skeptical of. So, as far as I know, there's sort of no existing institutional designs or proposals for democratic reforms of, I mean, you know, participatory democratic reforms of things like central banks and so on. But there are actually in other areas of science. I sort of grant in my dissertation that economics is back to science. And so I'm sort of thinking about looking maybe at some of those. I mean, just briefly, the best case is AIDS-related research and how AIDS activists became highly involved in design of clinical trials. Yeah. That's more about social movements, but there's sort of some interesting institutional questions there. So it's not really about, you know, economics per se, but it's just something I've been thinking about it in terms of a way to get at some of the questions I'm interested in.
I mean, it certainly would be a challenging and extraordinarily interesting thing to try to sort out what would be a democratic egalitarian vision of a monetary system, given that in the idea of a real utopia, an economy without money seems like just pure utopia. So the old Marxian vision was of communism without money. There'd be production, and it would be an economy where everything was free. It would be sort of like a giant kibbutz for the whole world. And that just seems, most people find that just completely implausible. There have been people who have defended that as an idea. We know that non-monetary economies, even of a fairly complicated character, can work on small scale. And the kibbutz is certainly an example where people in the internal distribution and activities, nobody was remunerated for anything in the classic kibbutz. So we know it's possible to have some kinds of economic integration without money, but it's hard to imagine complex global systems without some kind of medium of exchange. So if you think you could tackle that would be, of course,
I mean, there's the whole local currency issue. I mean, and that really is a design that exists, that is out there. But I honestly, I have a hard time getting excited about it. It's not, it doesn't strike me as a really utopian thing. It's kind of a cheery local institution that's not, I don't know, I just don't find it. I mean, maybe if I knew more about it, I would find it more satisfying.
What is the local currency issue?
Well, I mean, there are these, you know, I mean, Madison has one. A lot of, mostly smaller cities have.
Smaller cities with universities.
With universities have local currencies.
Okay,
what are they using, seashells?
They're usually, they're paper coupons or something like that.
What they are usually are labor accounts.
Okay.
You know, so
it's like a payment in kind almost.
It's every hour is equivalent. So an hour of dentistry and an hour of carpentry are the same, and an hour of babysitting, and there's a central registry where you register the number of hours you've contributed to the labor pool by providing a service for anybody who's a member of the pool, and then you can draw hours from the pool, and then there's an accounting system. So it's, and I think Cornell is the most famous case, right?
Yeah, well, Ithaca, yeah.
The Ithaca, I meant.
Yeah.
But
Cornell.
I'm sure it's Cornell's, perennial graduate students at Cornell probably designed, I don't know the history.
I think theirs got restrained by the government because it ended up being considered taxable.
Right, there was a big problem because of taxation. Yeah, that's true. It was, that's an interesting.
There's also this other institution that is called LTAA. The full name doesn't come to me, but it's this kind of economy where people kind of trade in hours of work.
Yeah, it's the same thing. Sometimes this is
without called currency, but
oh, I see. What?
However, it's highly restrictive, right? To become a member.
I mean, there's a lot of, there's a lot that's been written about this stuff too, so I just don't get excited about it.
My name's Molly. I've thought about a couple different things that are very different from each other for this project, probably because my research interests at this point go in very many different directions. But I guess the one I thought the most about, which again I'm not sure if it would qualify, is it's a specific program called Operation Understanding, that I think started in Philadelphia or DC, that takes 12 high school students, 6 black, 6 Jewish, 3 girls, 3 boys of each, and goes to 2 different trips, one to the Deep South and one to Israel and Senegal, and kind of tackles issues of race and religion in a context, and then, goes back, and I, you know, don't know too much about the program, but then there's obligations throughout a couple of years of passing on the information and the dialogues through the high schools that these students belong to. And I don't know, that's just something that I thought about was pretty interesting.
It's, yeah, I don't know what I mean, of course I think very highly of such experiments and such micro efforts at changing people's identities and sense of culture and sense of connection to other people and understanding.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not, it's not so, it isn't exactly within the gamut of what I was thinking about.
Right.
I'm prepared to be, you know, pushed into, out of, into whatever shape you want, so to speak. I'm easily convinced to expand the horizons. I guess as a real utopian project, one would have to ask, what would this mean as a, that's a bit of empirical data, what would it mean for the redesign of some broader institutional context? And I'm not sure how you would play that out.
Yeah, no, I'm not sure either. And that's, I mean, I have like five ideas written down on this piece of paper, and they're all pretty unrelated. But that was just the one I was thinking about today.
Oh, you want to talk about Molly?
Yes, I won't go down that recipe.
I'm Charity. Nice to meet you two, and I don't know. And I would like to continue, I would like to use this class as a as a structure to write about what I've been researching, which is urban land reform in Venezuela, most notably in Caracas, but I visited some different areas to see how it looks. But it was a program that was institutionalized and started to give land titles to people in the barrios who were, until then, essentially illegal squatters. So that's where it began, but there are all these institutional kind of setups and a lot of unintended consequences, both positive, and then of course there are negative as well. So I'm looking forward to this as using it as a framework to write about, because I've been finding it really difficult to write about it. And Empowered Participatory Governance, which is another book in the series, was really helpful in thinking about those things too, so just suggesting it. But yeah, that's what I want to continue writing about. And for the local time bank issue, the Venezuelan ambassador came and met with the director of that program. So they might try to institute one in Venezuela, just in case that's of any interest to you.
When he was here.
He came here, yeah. And
has anyone used the one here?
Hmm?
Has anyone used the one here?
No.
No,
I just learned that one.
My name is Hanif. I've been doing my research thus far on subprime mortgages, and in doing so, I've come to understand that rating agencies play a huge part in how not only credit, but how assets are being valued. So I'd love to utilize this course to get some understanding of how rating agencies work and if it's feasible to have an alternative to rating agencies. It sounds like a very, very formidable task, because it seems like rating agencies not only, you know, regulate themselves, but they also regulate other institutions. So it's kind of hard to see how you can kind of pick their roles in asset and credit, you know, value, and try to create an alternative to that. But I'm hoping that I can do something with rating agencies, and if not, focus on the, you know, I guess an alternative, or develop some type of idea for real property ownership. And, you know, and I'm not saying that it's feasible for every single person to own the home that they live in, but at least come up with an alternative for people to be a part of home ownership without the risk of losing everything if you, you know, commence that process and end up not being able to see it to its end, i.e. your traditional
mortgage. You know, one domain of institutional alternatives that might be really interesting with that set of concerns would be to look at land trusts, urban land trusts, as a way of controlling the housing market, essentially decommodifying land, take land out of the market, which then means that there's a co-ownership of all dwellings by the collective in some sense. You have to decide who are the trustees of the land trust and the residents. It's a way of creating affordable housing without losing all of the advantages of having a market in residences and some ownership rights, but without letting it be a free market. And this concept of land trusts is a way that that's been done for various things. It's often used for conservation purposes. In Wisconsin, there's land trusts to prevent development. But there are cases, I think Vermont has a very active urban land trust for housing. There's one of the people who was a participant in the Berkeley seminar I gave is a kind of expert on land trusts. He worked as an activist in the Vermont land trust stuff for a while. And if you were interested in pursuing those ideas, I could easily put you in touch with him.
My name is Eduardo. I suppose that I would need to struggle a bit from where I would want to write this particular proposal. One way to do so is from the United States, where there is a lot of literature and education right now about democratic schools and schools for social justice. So you can easily find several case studies and almost do a meta-analysis and try to question those models and in which way they can question or problematize this more neoliberal, more conservative core that's influencing educational policies right now. So that would be one way to do so. Another way to do so, which obviously would be more interesting to me in a way, because I'm from Chile, is to actually see how this is playing out in my own country. But I think that my problem there would be in terms of, if I look at policies, and I already said this, what's interesting about policy, especially in a socialist or so-called socialist government, is filled with a lot of progressive intentions and discourses and speeches. And in that sense, the socialist government, I think, has been very, this coalition government has been very successful in bringing under their umbrella a lot of social movements and those kind of things and reshaping them in a more market-wise way. So definitely that'll be interesting to look at those policies and see how they work out and what they, the possibilities they bring or do not bring. What I don't think would be so much easy is to find actual cases, for example, where this has been done at a local level because of this sort of accord between government and public schools and that kind of situation. So I would need to look at that down and see how I could really go down in a concrete way and see.
Have you met Harry Brighouse here, the professor in the philosophy of education? Well, he's definitely somebody you'll be in touch. I'll get you in touch with. He's a good friend of mine. He does philosophy of education. He's a extremely interesting, compelling person. He's been thinking a lot about what a real utopian educational system would look like, and indeed, although he hasn't actually done it, I've been trying to get him, he's agreed to do it, but he just hasn't done it, to actually develop a real utopias proposal around education as a system. So it's not so much about what you do in a classroom, although, of course, that's important as well. It's the design of the overall education system. What would be the principles that you would actually put in place to embody democratic egalitarian values? And he's been working on and thinking about that a lot, and would certainly have tons of suggestions and, you know, bibliography and things like that.
Did you say something with Brigman?
Brighouse. Harry Brighouse.
Yeah, my name is Feng Ying. I'm not quite sure how I can make connection to my previous works and discourse papers, because my previous work is pretty much primarily focused on the Korean welfare reforms and social policy reforms, basically since the democratization and the financial crisis. So basically, I actually have research on the macro levels of political reforms and the political process between the government and the trade unions and employer associations and other social groups. So right now I don't have any specific institutional case in mind. So actually I came to this class whether I can make another possible case study, not even if it is not directly related to my recent work. So I actually have some ideas about the regional economies and actually with the regional government and civil organization groups try to make some social partnership council to discuss about the possible economic systems and policies and their social policies. So that could be the one of the possible topics, but right now I'm not quite sure about them.
I think that's a great
My name is Kathy. I'm interested in looking at food sovereignty movement and how the ideals of the food sovereignty movement have been put in place in different contexts. Food sovereignty movement basically is trying to say trade is not number one. It's feeding people that's the number one priority of food policy, and also includes the environment, principles like taking care of the environment, rights of women, biodiversity, things like that. And it's really interesting counter-movement, I find, especially because it's very difficult to put in place, but I think there's a lot of examples where similar things have been put in place, and yet problems coming out with them. The one I'm most familiar with is the farming system in Canada for some products where the production matches the consumption, so it's not export or import. So for eggs or milk, which they're just, you make enough. Every year decide how much is enough made. And so there's sort of some obvious problems with that, which is if I want to be a farmer tomorrow in Quebec, no matter how much or money I had, buying a farm isn't enough and buying cows isn't enough. Have to buy stock in that system, and that's sort of a point of contention, because it is really an all or nothing system. And just some other things that I've thought about recently that relate to that in an interesting way is the geographical designation on a lot of foods are run in really similar ways. So like for champagne or for certain cheeses, you can only make it if you're in that specific region, and there's the amount that's produced is controlled. The big difference for that is those tend to be geared towards growing markets rather than and markets that are for exports, so the markets are growing a lot faster.
Yeah, food systems are certainly an interesting domain to think about these things, because it's one of the areas where you can experiment, and there's new innovations all the time. Things like CSAs, for example, community supported agriculture. I mean, I'm sure things like that have been around a lot for a long time, but that's been a very big development in recent years and has created a different relationship between consumers and producers in some places. But it's different from a food sovereignty movement in that it tries to build new kinds of social relations as the basis for creating a new system as opposed to creating new constraints, which, so.
And one of the really interesting things about the CSAs is that they only work around cities, generally. And most of Wisconsin, CSAs aren't very viable solution, partly because the transport costs in that context are overwhelming. For what you would get back.
Yeah, because there's no economies of scale in the transport, obviously.
And the distance as well.
Right.
All right, I'm Wes. I'm right now doing ethnographic research on emerging networks and communities and institutions of evangelical Christians in the United States and Europe who are theologically conservative and socially and economically progressive. Yes, there is an evangelical left of sorts. That's what I'm interested in. The way that these movements, the kind of values and principles of these groups are being incarnated largely are in kind of experiments that look a lot like the 19th century intentional communities, actually, community houses, hall houses, that kind of thing, where you have people in urban areas living in co-ops, starting businesses together, trying to create these kind of micro-alternative communities according to these principles. So I'm interested in why are they incarnating in this kind of way? How are they constructing themselves in relation to the evangelical community and larger political context in the United States? And there are a few particular cases in Madison and Kansas City and Minneapolis and some other places that I've been looking at and working on and interested in using as my case studies. So.
My name is Ido. I'm torn between a lot of ideas, most of which I have hesitation about. I would like to do something about workers' councils or anarcho-syndicalism in some way. I don't know whether that would be on a general level or taking some specific instance in which it happened historically. I hesitate to do that because I don't know what I would have to add. I think there's also quite a bit of information and research on that. Other topics are democratic schools, which are close to free schools, called shureis in Japan, that I think are very interesting, that have been coming out in the past decade or so, a little bit longer. There's an obscure development economist called Manfred Max Neef, who attempted to create this way to organize the economy around human needs as opposed to the way that the market allocates resources, and it's very under-articulated, and it might be interesting. He tried to actually institute it, and it might be interesting to look for that sort of thing. I don't know. I'm like Molly, I've got new ideas every day. I'm not sure where I'll go. I need to consider the viability, sustainability, etc., of my ideas, but
Something like the anarcho-syndicalist tradition and its models.
Yeah.
While there's a huge literature on it, it's also the case that very little of that literature is analytically rigorous and careful, and attempts to actually establish what the model was, and how people envisioned it working. So it's not. Even though you said you weren't sure you could make a contribution, it's the kind of domain where it may not be possible, but in which it's also a huge amount of stuff that's fairly mushy, as you could put order in it, which would be a contribution.
Yeah.
So it's worth thinking about it.
Yeah. Hi, my name is Guillaume Noe. I'm hoping to use this seminar to as a springboard to kind of launch my project on the social economy in Quebec. And just broadly defined, the social economy is an economy that is located between state and market. So in the Quebec instance, organizations within civil society will just distribute services to a population. And more I've been reading about it as I kind of observed that there are lots of conflict occurring within civil society over representation, for example. There are two main councils, if I can use those words, that pledge allegiance to different co-ops or different style of the social economy. And so my interest at this point is to map out the social configurations of the social economy, and have a specific interest in the daycare provisions in Quebec. So.
Quebec is one of the cases that figures at least a little bit in one of the chapters, both on the daycare and the newer elder care services, which in some ways are more, even more novel I mean, the Quebec system for both of these are distinctive, but I think the cooperative provision of elder care services is a pretty unusual system and very interesting from a utopia's point of view. Well, there's a lot of action going on in here. I, shall we say, deeply look forward to reading all of your papers and anticipate learning a lot from it. I think on a lot of these topics, I will either directly have suggestions as you begin to formulate them, or even more richly can plug you into various networks. One of the reasons to think early in the semester about your papers and to kind of get this going rather than to let it move on is that one of the ways in which I can help ratchet up whatever projects you are doing is by, you know, getting you connected to people who I know work on these themes. And sometimes that takes a little bit of time to establish. So the sooner you can figure out what you're doing, the better. As you saw from the syllabus, the strategy for the seminar is to give you a month at the end of the semester where we won't meet as on a weekly basis. So that unlike many seminars, you actually have a fair chance at getting a serious term paper done in one semester. We will meet then every week until the 10th of April, and then there'll be a month off before we have our mini conference. One other little detail. I have to be on the East Coast for an early Friday meeting on the 22nd, which means Thursday, the 21st of February. I have to take a flight earlier in the day and can't have that week. That week I can't meet on Thursday. So I've scheduled the class tentatively for Wednesday of that week. Is that possible for everyone? Does somebody, anybody have a conflict? You have a conflict? Would there be, what's the timing of the conflict? Because we could maybe even have a class later than 4:30.
Once they finish at 7:30.
Is there anything, would earlier on Wednesday, I mean earlier in the day gets harder for most people. Depends. Earlier works. Is an earlier in the afternoon on a Wednesday the 20th possible for other people? Mm. No?
Yeah, I teach at 2:30.
Well, an alternative, which is not necessarily an alternative would be to skip that week and then just, you know, move everything. It would mean that would, I mean, the way to justify it, so to speak, would be that you could work more intensively on really getting your, you know, materials together for the proposal and the thematic sketch. We could have a little mini break in the course on the week of the 20th, and then everything else would get pushed back 1 week. It means that there'd be only 3 weeks of sort of uninterrupted writing at the end of the semester, but it would at least it would mean we wouldn't have to schedule the class at a time when some people couldn't come. Is that, that seem okay? I think it's a better solution than missing, than having some people not be able to come to a class. Okay, I will change this on the website so that I'll bring it to class, or you can download a new schedule. And so we will not meet the week of February 21st, and then everything else will just be moved down one session. Okay, I think that's a better way to do it. Okay.
I've got one question about the content of the readings. I don't have a large background in a lot of theory about, basically a lot of social theory. And I don't know how that will affect
Let me say two things. First of all, it's actually, from my point of view, it's nice to have someone without a lot of background reading this text, because I hope it'll be accessible. I mean, I'm trying to write it in a way that's very clear. I go through the steps of the argument. I define all the concepts. And your background, you have some background. I mean, you know, you're an intellectual, you're in graduate school, you know, you know how to read difficult material. So one of the things from my point of view, for that half of that particular function, is that's not a problem. It would be good for me to force somebody who isn't adept at social theory to read it, so to speak. Secondly, I think a lot of these ideas are ideas which, if you've been working on food sovereignty and on questions of the nature of the system in which you live and what ways to move beyond it, you've actually thought a lot about many of the dimensions of these kinds of questions, even if you haven't formalized it in a way. There's a couple of chapters, I would say, in the book. The chapters which are the most sort of hardcore social theory would be chapter 3, which is a review of the Marxist tradition and how it thinks about alternatives, and chapter 7, the theory of transformation, discusses the complexity of what it means to have an actual theory of deliberate social change, so that involves, you know, a fair amount of theoretical discussion. But I don't spend a lot of time discussing classical theory and other people's theory, except for that chapter on Marx. I don't march through what Habermas had to say about this and what Foucault had to say about this. I just sort of state the case and lay out the arguments for the way I think these things should be approached. In terms of your writing a paper, I don't think it's an issue at all, because by the time you actually get down to write it, you will have a whole menu of concepts. So, yeah.
Are there any of these chapters that we should not print ahead because you might be working on them as the semester progresses?
The chapters which have the biggest holes in them, chapter 10, Symbiotic Transformation, is basically just a slightly revised version of a paper I wrote a while ago on a slightly different topic, but which, that is, it was a paper on the problem of class compromise, which is an example of symbiotic strategies. So it'll figure in it, but I didn't actually refashion it for the purposes of this book. Chapter 10, therefore, will get quite substantially revised, and I'm hoping to get it done well before the class, because it would be more useful for me. Chapters 2 and 3 both have holes in them. That is, both of these have the character of explaining the problem of what social empowerment in the state means and social empowerment in the economy, and then going through a whole bunch of examples. And in both of them, I reach a point where I say, I'm going to discuss the following examples and haven't done it yet. So I would, you know, hold off copying 5 and 6. I'm less confident that I will have those revised by the time we hit them, just because of other things I have to get done, but it's possible. All the other chapters, I think, will be tinkered with at most. Is the weekly task of what I'm calling interrogations, is that all clear? Everybody understands? Some of you have taken seminars from me and have a feel for it. What often happens at the beginning of seminars is that the interrogations are too elaborate in a certain sense. That is, they don't actually help to set up a discussion. The purpose of the interrogations, so this is, keep saying to yourself, the mantra is, what conversation do I want to have at this seminar, having read this chapter? What do I want to have people talk about? And then your interrogation of the chapter should set up that conversation. You know, this is, I distill the agenda for what we're actually going to talk about from your interrogations. They can be short or long. I don't put any constraint on the length. And since I'm also eager for editorial and, well, I don't mean typos, but you know, your criticisms and issues you have in it. You can, one way to do it is you could partition your interrogation to be one part that's for me, in a sense. These are problems I'm having with the text. I don't understand what you're talking about in these paragraphs. I think you say this, but what do you mean? Or something like that. You can have that separated out from, this is what I want to talk about in the seminar, and then explain and elaborate those points. So send those to me. I then write comments on them and then put them all together as a packet and then post them on the class website and let everyone know that they're ready to be read. So they'll be distributed to everyone. Ideally, I'll get them in by midnight or 1 o'clock, you know, late at night on Wednesday. So if everybody gets them in on time, except on a couple of Wednesdays when, for one reason or another, I have some Wednesday night thing I have to do, I will sit down and just do them very intensively on Wednesday, so they'll be waiting for you when you get up Thursday morning. Because it helps the discussion a bit. It's not absolutely essential, but you've at least had a chance to skim through everybody's memos. If you can, you know, there's not a lot of reading each week. It's mostly these are sort of 15 to 20 pages or so. Some weeks there's some supplementary readings, but the core reading, which is the ones you'll be interrogating, are not that long. If you read them earlier in the week and just send me this thing ahead of time, I will write my comments on your interrogations as soon as I get them, and it makes it easier for me to get it all done in a timely manner on Wednesday if a few of them have come in earlier. I know a lot of you in the end will probably over weekends do some of the reading. You know, that's when people... So just read it and write the comments right away and get them to me. Okay?
Quick question. How do you feel about eating during this class?
Absolutely. I will... No. A class that meets 4:30 to 7.
He feels scrumptious about it.
I didn't do it. I didn't bring... I'll bring some nibbles. Everybody's encouraged to just bring stuff, and we can have... I'll have a bunch of bowls here. I will bring a bunch of bowls in which people can dump stuff. I will bring stuff. You're all encouraged to bring stuff. It can be healthy and unhealthy. You know, some reasonable combination of healthy and unhealthy stuff.
But we'll measure the work hours of what it requires to bring the stuff here.
Right.
And it should all be equal in the end.
Unfortunately, our comrades in Argentina will not be able to participate in our nibbles, but... we will shower them with good food when they arrive in May. Okay. Yeah.
Kind of sample empirical study in mind.